On this page, there are three examples of what I have termed here pre-Christian models of the soul guide or psychopomp, although that is a term that is used in the later tradition of the Greek mystery religions and is much used today by literary critics and Jungians, for example. The term does not actually occur in the texts we'll be studying, but it's a legitimate way of describing the fact that we're going to look at three models that would have been known to the early Christian community. These were, as it were, in the air. They were very famous models. Two of them, because they come from Greco-Roman antiquity, the one from Plato and the other from Cicero, and the third because of the Jewish origins of Christianity, the intertestamental literature, the powerful example of the angel or prophet, but particularly the angel as soul guide. As we'll see, the other two models represent rather more classical images of the philosopher on the one hand as the one who leads out of darkness, and the other, in the case of Cicero, will provide us with an example of a dream in which the metaphor or parable of an ancestor teaching ancestral wisdom is used as a way of helping a person realize the need for commitment to virtue and realizing the limitations of the world around them. Three different models of the soul guide: the philosopher, the angel, or the angel and the prophet, and then finally the model under Cicero of the ancestor. And the timeline shows where these relatively fit. You can see Plato in his years approximately 427 to 327 BC, and the Greek philosophical traditions that surrounded him. The fate of the nation of Israel is listed below. You can see that during Plato's period, Israel was under Persian domination, to be succeeded by Greek domination as a result of the aggressive military campaign of Plato's pupil, Aristotle's pupil, Alexander the Great. The next period would be the short-lived period of Maccabean rule for Israel, and it's probably during that period, and maybe a little before, during under influence to some limited extent of the domination by the Greek generals who succeeded Alexander in the region of Israel, that some of the apocalyptic intertestamental literature, including the Book of Enoch, began to emerge, and it probably has multiple sections from different periods, but I've placed it on the timeline approximately where many scholars believe it and the Book of Daniel would have arisen, around 200 BC or a little later. And then Cicero, who lives from about 106 BC to 43 BC, who provides this retelling of Plato's myth of that is the story of someone who has a vision of the cosmos and as a result of seeing the heavens being transported into the heavens realizes the littleness of the world around them. So we'll look at these three examples because they were famous examples, vivid examples, and they were present in the minds and the culture as the early Christian literature was being written. I must apologize for the speed and therefore the rather superficial brevity with which we'll have to consider each of these sources. For those of you who would like to spend more time with them, I certainly encourage you to read the texts in a more leisurely way, but also I will provide links to additional lectures that describe these texts in slightly more detail, and they're completely optional, but for those who wish to look in a little more detail at these texts. Let's begin first with Plato's famous story of the parable of the caves, taken from the Republic. And here it is the philosopher who is the guide. And let's look at the text itself, the first two paragraphs. Plato sets the story of this parable, of this myth that he is telling. Imagine that there are people living in an underground cave, and more than that, they are bound. That is to say, if you look down at the picture, which tries to give a schematic of the cave, you can't quite tell, it's not as obvious, but the people are actually chained in place. They cannot move. They're looking at a wall, and behind them is a fire, and there's a kind of a pathway along which people can walk, and effectively, they're watching shadow plays all the time. They are not seeing reality. They're seeing only shadows having to do with the fire behind them. They aren't even aware of the existence of the great wide world beyond them, symbolized by that picture of the sky up out beyond the cave. So these are people who are living in a world effectively of unreality. And then if you drop down below the schematic picture in the picture of the sky, Plato's powerful statement when he is told that these are a strange image, strange prisoners, and Plato says, homoius hemin, they are like us, they are like ourselves. We are the people who are chained in this cave. We see unreality, and we have to be liberated in order to perceive the truth of what exists beyond us. And he goes on to describe that these people living in the cave would imagine that what they see is reality, but if you drop down a little bit in the highlighted text, truth, he says, for them is nothing but the shadows of the images. Then in his parable, he goes on to say what happens if the prisoners are released. Or if you take one prisoner and let him release him, first even looking at the fire behind him will cause pain in his eyes, but gradually he'll get used to that, and suddenly he'll realize the limitation of the shadows that they've been that he's been looking at. And finally, if you drop down still further, he is lifted up, he is enabled to reach beyond the cave, and gradually, little by little, he can stand the sight first of dark reflected things, dusky objects in the outer world, the heavens first, and then finally, last of all, he is able to see the sun, which for Plato is the great symbol of the idea, or we might call it the archetype, the form of the good. That's the highest thing that one can learn to see. He's describing the philosophical journey to recognize that what we see are only partial shadows of a much more real world, of the noetic world, the world which we are capable, to use his language and the language that the Christian tradition will eagerly assimilate, if we engage in contemplation, theoria, we will discover the ability to perceive beyond the cave, to behold realities that we've only dimly imagined. So he then, and again, remember that in these blue bars, I've included my own little comments. If you drop down, you'll see he emphasizes the necessity for compassion for the cave dwellers. That is to say, once you've seen the truth, you then hopefully will respond by having compassion on those who are still behind. But if you go back and try to serve them, if you drop down further, to the yellow highlighted text just above the next blue bar, the blue bar that says Plato's interpretation of his parable, you'll see there that the danger is that if you then do go back and try to preach the truth to the cave dwellers, they would prefer to put you to death. They don't want to be told that what they're seeing is limited and unreal. And then dropping down to the section that I've called Plato's interpretation of his parable, he says that this is an allegory for the ascent of the soul into the noetic world, the world which is the real world. What we see around us are simply appearances. There is a deeper reality. Plato believed in the existence of the One, a God beyond all gods, into union with whom we are ultimately called, and that movement towards union with the One entails a recognition of the limitation of all that we see around us. Dropping down a little bit further in the text, you'll see in a highlighted and brown-colored text, he says that it's not surprising that the philosopher who has seen the truth, when forced to interact with worldly things, will appear ridiculous. This person is trying to accommodate their vision of truth to the more mundane activities which are only partly to do with things that are true, and therefore this person will seem to be a bumbling idiot. Dropping down to the next blue bar, Plato then goes on to say that the contemplatives, those who are able to look beyond the surface, to behold the glory of the divine, to see the true forms of the good and the true and the beautiful, these individuals cannot be permitted to simply enjoy their contemplative life apart from society. They must be compelled to return, both to serve the state as educators and as legislators, but also to enlighten others who haven't seen this. As he puts it, dropping down again a little further, they must be made to descend again among the prisoners in the den, whether they want to or not. And he says this is not unjust, because precisely this kind of philosophical instruction that people have received is to enable them to be good citizens. So for Plato, what we would call contemplative life entails a willingness to share the fruit of that experience in ordinary civic activities. So for him, the philosopher is the one who has both seen and is now responsible for teaching others to see and even to take their role. The philosopher king was a model that he and Aristotle tended to hope would eventually triumph, to take their place in politics as well. Dropping down to number two, to the Book of Enoch, here we have, and we'll go through this very quickly, not the philosopher as the one who enables one to see the truth of the heavenly world that lies beyond, but here and now we've entered the realm of Jewish apocalyptic literature, of the kind of prophetic literature of which the Book of Daniel is a good example. Here we have the angelic world as the angels, as the mediators, the ones who enable us to learn, to perceive, and who are, in a very real sense, our soul guides. The angels become those who guide the soul in their journey towards God. And if you look in the Book of Enoch now, at chapter 14, the first section, Enoch arises up in his vision, up towards the heavens. The winds cause him to fly upward. He sees this mysterious interconnectedness of fire and ice. And again, read these texts in a little more detail if you like. Dropping down to the blue bar entitled Glory of God Enthroned, he has this vision of the Ancient of Days, of God himself. And then following that, just above the next blue bar, above chapter 17, the glory of heaven and earth, one of the holy ones, the angels, comes to him, rouses him, stands him up, and brings him as far as the door. So now the angel becomes his guide on the rest of his spirit journey. And in chapter 17, the ruling angels, the archons, take and bring him to a place where there are beings like flaming fire. And part of the whole goal of the Book of Enoch is to describe the fate of misbehaving angels, of the angels who fell in love with human women and had children from them in ancient times. And again, this is a story taken from an interpretation of the Book of Genesis, but it's much more than that, because of course at this period in the life and the history of Israel, there was the problem of intermarriage. Should Jews intermarriage with Gentiles? And this story is attempting to raise the stakes to the cosmic, that just as angels are punished for having commerce with human women in the same way, the implication is that the Jewish people must remain pure, cannot intermarry. And that was an important practical ethical question at the time, which this image of the angel spirit guide is enabling this very ancient prophet, Enoch, to now proclaim in this book that's allegedly been rediscovered. And in chapter 17, if you look, the angels bring him to this place where they see the fate of the terrible of the angels who have behaved badly, and he also sees the sapphire throne, the throne of God himself. And then the angel describes and points out to him, if you drop down a little further, this flaming fire, the place that is the end of heaven and earth, that becomes a prison for the stars and for the hosts of heaven. Dropping down to the end of this section, chapter 19, he interacts with several archangels. The archangel Uriel says to him, in effect explaining the condemnation of these bad angels, here are the angels who have, and you can read for yourself what they've done, and they have a terrible fate in store for them. So this story is a reminder of the fact that there already was in the mind of the people of Israel and in the early Christian church this model of angelic powers that could be a kind of spirit guide, enabling one to see beyond the world, to perceive deeper realities, and then to realize the implications of these things for one's own ethical life, a kind of an analog to the philosopher spirit guide of the ancient ancient Greco-Roman tradition. And dropping down now to the last of these three examples, Cicero, the ancestor as psychopomp. Cicero has effectively created a Latin version of Plato's story of the myth of Ur, the story of a soldier who dies and returns from the dead and tells the story of what happens in heaven, the judgment of the souls, the necessity for choosing a good life, the necessity for living a virtuous life. Cicero is retelling this story in Latin, and his retelling of the story becomes very important in the literary tradition of the Latin-speaking world. C.S. Lewis has pointed out that throughout Christian times, up until the relatively modern period, every well-educated person who had learned Latin, that was pretty much everybody who was well-educated prior to the 19th century or so, read The Dream of Scipio. This was a part of their formal education, and so the imagery and the mythology that it contains would have been very well known in the throughout the later development of the Christian tradition, but even early on as well. And again, it's a retelling of a story that had already importantly influenced the Greek tradition. And Cicero tells this as a dream. He has it, if you look at the text itself, there's a little explanation in a blue bar of who the psychopomp, who the soul guide or spirit guide is. It's Scipio Africanus, this famous general and hero of the Republic. And the story, the Scipio of the dream, is actually his descendant. So he is told by his father and by his grandfather, he has this vision of the heaven, of the heavenly spheres in which they dwell, because they were heroes, because they served the fatherland, because they lived lives of great virtue, that he too can do that. And as a result of this, he has a vision of the heavens themselves. And I've included some rather stylized pictures of galaxies and the Milky Way to just give us a sense of the transcendent nature of the story. It's intended to enable one to look beyond the ordinary up into heaven and then looking at the starry sky to realize how much more there is to existence than our own little concerns. And that really is part of the point of the story. And it's important to bear in mind, if you drop down to the diagram entitled The Ptolemaic Universe, remember that in the conception of this period, the Earth was at the center, surrounded by successively different spheres, beginning with the Moon, and then Mercury, Venus, then the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, and then finally, the outermost sphere, the realm of the fixed stars, and then in later Christian tradition, the primum mobile, the place wherein God dwells in a particular way, where all motion is from, because all of these spheres were regarded as being in a constant process of movement, as we shall see. Well, let's look at the text in number 17, underneath the bar titled The Ptolemaic Universe. Africanus, his soul guide, his spiritual guide, and his ancestor says, "How long will you fix your thoughts on the lowly earth? Do you not see the lofty region you have entered? These are the nine circles, or spheres, by which the whole is joined. The outermost is heaven, and then it contains the supreme God." And in a sense, it is. It is identifiable to some extent with God. Then he talks about the different planets and their meanings. And again, if you want to look at this in a little more detail, there's an additional lecture you can listen to. The meaning of Jupiter and of Saturn and of Mars in the mythology of the period, dropping down to the dark mythology of the moon. But the most important thing that is given here, and it was also found in Plato's story, is the idea of the music of the spheres, the belief that the universe itself is creating a constant melody, a constant harmony, which we don't hear because, in effect, we're always hearing it. We've heard it since our birth, and we're not sensitive to it anymore. There's a blue bar that says the music of the spheres, it's this agreeable sound of proportion, dropping down to the next picture of a woman playing in a lyre, and a much later image of an attempt to actually define which tones or notes were being given off by which planetary sphere. It's a kind of a stylized line drawing which tries to illustrate this notion that people believe that the universe really was singing. But notice the highlighted text under that red section where the woman with the lyre is sitting. Learned men, by imitating this harmony on stringed instruments and in song, have gained for themselves a return to this region. So the best music, the best poetry, the best chant will enable people to enter again, as it were, to ascend into the realm of the spheres. Again, a reminder of this sense of the powerful effect of music. Music is a reflection of an order in the universe, and it's a very great significance in this idea of the meaning of philosophy and indeed a philosophical guidance. Dropping down to the little map of the Roman Empire and the blue bar that says, "Glorious heavens, insignificant empire." This is really the ethical implication of this story, that that the young Scipio should keep his gaze fixed upon heavenly things and scorn the earthly. Dropping down to chapter 23, "Look on high, contemplate the eternal home. Virtue herself should lead you on to true glory." And then finally, dropping down to the next and last blue bar, "True glory lies in the pursuit and attainment of virtue. You are a god, if a god is that which lives, feels, remembers, and foresees. An immortal spirit moves your frail body." Dropping down to the last section I've included, section 28, he mentions that the best tasks are those that are in defense of your native land, and if you are defending, as Cicero thought he was doing, the glories of the Republic against what he saw as the encroachment of a kingdom or even a horrible empire, that would enable one to live a life in the realm of the blessed. And those who do not commit themselves to a life of proper virtue are going to be tortured in the next life, and that was a common belief as well. So here we've seen several examples of the kind of spirit guide that was present in popular imagination. The idea of the philosopher who can teach and lead and enable one to look beyond the surface of external things to perceive the good, the true, and the beautiful from Plato. The notion of God's intermediaries, the angels that guide us to look out beyond our own concerns and then perceive the realities of heaven and even the fate of angels as having significance for us ethically. And then Cicero's retelling of Plato's myth, very close indeed to the time of the birth of Christ, in which one has a kind of a focus on the need to serve your local country, but not necessarily to do what the ruler wants you to do. Remember that Cicero was killed, was executed for his devotion to republican ideals and for his failure to accept the inevitable development of the Roman Empire under Octavian or Augustus. So these three examples are reminders to us of the kind of spiritual guidance or spiritual direction that people already expected in the world around them, and it's against this background that we can look in a little more detail at some philosophical models. And again, there are additional optional lectures on these texts for those who wish to listen to them.